Hi, Luke Savage. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Luke Savage is a writer based in Toronto, a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine. He's quite prolific. His writing is now popping up all over the left in the journals. Luke Savage, after the November election, Biden's narrow victory over Trump created great relief in lots of us and, in fact, some hopes. And those hopes were especially strong because Biden and his advisors met with Bernie Sanders and the Congressional Progressive Caucus that's grown to near 100 members over the last couple of years. Biden met with them and then fashioned a very ambitious set of plans for his presidency. That was then. Now, in less than a year, Biden's initial high levels of support is way down to a quite low 40%. His once ambitious plans have been greatly reduced. We'll be talking first about what happened and then discuss how maybe the crusading spirit can be revived, that the Progressive Caucus could maybe have some important accomplishments, especially in dealing with climate change. That's my hypothesis. First, Luke Savage, though, what happened?
I think the answer is really twofold. There's the popular explanation for these developments, which is there are a number of Democratic lawmakers, particularly in the United States Senate, who, because of the thin legislative majority the Democrats have in the Senate, they're holding up the whole agenda, is basically the popular explanation. And of course, there's something to that. In a body like the United States Senate, when there's a majority this thin, individual lawmakers do have a tremendous amount of power. But I think that to really understand what's going on, there are a few pretty important asterisks to attach to that explanation. The first is that the primary reason for opposition to an agenda like this from figures like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, you know, it's framed as a kind of earnest, good faith ideological dispute or something like that. And I think with these two figures in particular, Manchin and Sinema, you can see how cynical and kind of disingenuous a framing that is, because really this is just corporate influence. You know, there are lawmakers who will happily operate at the behest of various corporate lobbies, and these two just happen to be the ones in the spotlight who are doing so at the moment. But it's important to understand that this problem goes far beyond two Democratic senators. The model that the Democratic Party, its leadership anyway, have embraced is one that basically necessitates accepting corporate influence over the legislative process and over the kinds of commitments you make often during campaigns and things like that, but especially over the legislative process once you have won an election. So in the case of Biden, Biden built a coalition of anti-Trump voters, younger voters, and other people who were kind of, you know, people on the left who've been part of the Bernie Sanders coalition. He brought them in by having what was on paper, at least, a pretty ambitious, in relative terms at least, pretty ambitious legislative agenda. And he also kind of duly rolled this out a few months after taking office. And we were getting the $6 trillion figure for the phase of his legislative agenda that is currently being debated. So what you're now seeing is the way that corporate influence exerts itself on an agenda like this. And this is really not just about, like I said, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. The Democratic leadership has embraced this model for a long time. You know, what the basic model is involves talking to liberal voters on the one hand and talking to corporate interests on the other. And in D.C., popular pressure really doesn't have that many avenues to exert itself. If we're talking about the Democratic Party, we have a few public interest groups. We have the labor movement, you know, and there are a few representatives as well, of course, who make it their business to try to represent a popular majority in one way or another and who advocate for progressive policies. But the fact is, corporate lobbies really have the ear of lawmakers much more than any of these groups or individuals I just mentioned. They provide the campaign cash in a lot of cases. They have, I mean, quite literally armies of lobbyists who are able to capture the debate, capture the discussion around all kinds of issues very effectively. And so, surprise, surprise, when you have a few months of debate over something like the reconciliation bill that we're currently talking about, aspects of which are opposed by a lot of these corporate interests. By the time it's passed through the, you know, sausage making process or whatever, the $6 trillion becomes $4 trillion, $3.5 trillion, and now it looks like less than $2 trillion. And the things that are left over, even the laudable things, become the types of things that were originally pitched as universal and are now heavily means tested or funded in a much less holistic way. What looks to be happening around the Democrats' universal pre-K pledge is one example of that. So that's one thing that happens. Then you have other things that are left over that might be good, but are just not the kinds of things that are as likely to be opposed by capital, really. So a good example of this is that Democrats explicitly pledged to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. They nominally had the votes to do this if they'd have been willing to overrule an unelected legislative referee called the Senate parliamentarian, but they weren't willing to do that because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and, you know, various other lobbies were able to ensure that they didn't go ahead with that by exerting pressure in all of these direct ways and through the kind of soft power that they command just by virtue of being large organized bodies with lots of money. So what happened to the Biden agenda? Well, I was always skeptical that something like this was going to be enacted under Biden. There were some encouraging signs at the start of his presidency with these big numbers, $6 trillion, things like that, which you didn't see at the start of Barack Obama's presidency. But it's always struck me that you can't cleave to this model of trying to represent a predominantly liberal electoral base, represent majority opinion, which, by the way, you know, popular opinion, insofar as we can gauge it through polling, is in favor of all kinds of things that are in this reconciliation package. But you can't simultaneously represent that opinion while also taking all of these corporate donations and allowing corporate actors to have such a high degree of influence, both over fundraising and then correspondingly over how the party operates and the kinds of things its lawmakers are willing to vote for.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to Luke Savage. We've been discussing the troubles of the party. I have a sense, I'm more optimistic still than you are for a number of reasons, and maybe we can have agree or disagree maybe on some of the issues, but let me bring them up. You argued that there's very little room for legislation that capital would oppose. Now, my sense is that that's true, but there are reforms I think that can be won. That's because, in my sense, the Progressive Caucus has still a considerable power, which they flexed for quite a while before giving in. And I think maybe giving in can be seen as a strategic defeat in hopes of a longer-term victory. That may be just a pleasant fantasy. But let's talk about that. First, I think maybe talk about the Progressive Caucus. You saw them as, my sense is, pretty weak. I think that's, of course, true in some senses, but not in others. What do you see as the possibilities of the Progressive Caucus?
Well, I certainly think there are real signs for optimism. As you said at the beginning, the Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus in Congress. You also have within the Progressive Caucus a group of lawmakers who are small but constitute a larger group of genuinely left-wing lawmakers. I mean, this is unprecedented in my lifetime, certainly. There are lots of reasons to be optimistic about that, but both of these groups, should we say the roughly six lawmakers who are often referred to as the squad, and then the larger Progressive Caucus as well, neither of these groups is currently powerful enough to exert sufficient influence over the legislative process that they're currently able to defeat the forces that are working against their agenda. That's not to say that they haven't grown much more powerful than they were, but the progressive left in the United States, however one defines it, has been quite weak for quite a number of decades. And so we were kind of starting from a position of very marginal influence. That influence, I think, has certainly grown. And it's not, as is often said in the mainstream press, it's not the case that these folks represent a kind of marginal agenda that is totally off the radar of average Americans and only represent a fringe of the electorate or something like that. That's not true at all. The agenda that these folks are running on, the agenda that Bernie Sanders centered in his two presidential campaigns, is for the most part a very popular one. And that's worth celebrating and acknowledging as well. But the scale of corporate influence on American politics is such that you need numbers in Congress, but you also need tremendous institutional capacity outside of Congress to offer any real counterweight. And we're still not there yet. You know, there's still a process that needs to happen. There's a lot of organizing that needs to happen, a lot more elections that need to be won, a lot more incumbents that need to be primaried, but then also a lot more institutional capacity needs to be built. And I have generally been fairly sympathetic to the way that the Congressional Progressive Caucus has kind of held the line throughout the reconciliation package debate, although I am less sympathetic. Once we started getting numbers pitched below this $3.5 trillion figure, you know, they were crossing what had been their own red line. And what happened last Friday when Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Progressive Caucus, agreed to vote for this bipartisan infrastructure framework without a corresponding vote on the reconciliation package. Once the progressives in Congress, aside from the six members of the squad, voted for this infrastructure framework, it's not clear to me at all how they are actually going to cajole moderates into voting for the Build Back Better reconciliation package in a few weeks' time. And so I'm worried that they have given up their only bargaining chip because, as usual, they face the dilemma that progressives in Congress have often faced as a marginal force, which is that they're faced with a choice of giving the thumbs down and not being able to take anything back to their constituents and not being able to say, look, we got X, Y, and Z through despite having to make compromises. They're faced with the choice to do that or, on the other hand, claim that the glass is half full and that they were able to get something rather than nothing. Whether they're even able to get something rather than nothing, I think, is still an open question. We'll have to see what happens with this legislative package over the next few weeks and whether it goes to a vote and what happens if it does. But in general, I'm very pleased with the developments in terms of left-wing challengers winning primaries and the Congressional Progressive Caucus being larger than it was. But what we've seen over the past few months is that it still lacks the votes and the institutional capacity to have the kind of influence that we ultimately need it to.
Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Luke Savage. My sense is that even now, there's still a lot of money there. What's interesting is how little money is required, let's say, in contrast to the military budget, for example, or many other budget items, and how little money is required to get to universal child care that is publicly financed, like public schools. I mean, there's limitations to what they can get, but it seems to me that that remains in the budget, and Biden could be forced by the Progressive Caucus because they need the Progressive Caucus is also important because they represent a fairly substantial part of the Democratic Party voting and of the Democratic Party's constituency. And unless they can be enthused, for example, get out the vote stuff in 2022 and 24, their, you know, electoral prospects, unless they can be enthused, become much less possible of succeeding. And I think that the child care and elder care provisions and the monies that go to them can really be a foot in the door towards a very interesting kind of welfare state. And, of course, the free tuition for community colleges, which I believe is still in the bill, those things create possibilities of enlarging over the years and, in fact, creating much larger, quote, liberal constituencies. What's your thought about those reforms and the idea of getting your foot in the door? Give us a sense of your sense of those reforms, both in climate change showing the way for a different economy as to energy and, let's say, child care and elder care.
Right. So, I mean, I agree those are important. And I also agree that if you advance certain kinds of reforms, they can create bigger constituencies for bigger liberal constituencies, as you put it. But based on, I think, a lot of the changes that have been made to the bill, I think the risk is when you get means testing introduced, you end up not building new constituencies because the beneficiaries are so kind of diffuse, the beneficiaries of these programs, that, you know, a lot of people don't really notice. So I believe where we are with the universal pre-K, for example, was that originally they were going to fund it beginning next year. They're going to fund it 100% for 3 years. And I believe now the proposal in the draft bill is an escalating scale where they're going to each year first year $4 billion, $6 billion, $8 billion, and then they're going to pay diminishing percentages of the state costs for funding it. And then in 2028, money will be phased out entirely. So, of course, the bill hasn't passed yet, so we don't know if that's what's going to happen. But if something like that did happen, I think that the prospects for building new constituencies around it would certainly be imperiled. I also agree with what you said about the Congressional Progressive Caucus and how the party kind of needs them. That's certainly true. You know, they represent constituencies that are very important to the Democratic Party as a whole. The problem is that, you know, the Democratic Party is often functionally unable and structurally unable to operate on the basis of even quite crass electoral self-interest. All of these programs and policies and social spending items that formed part of the original reconciliation package, you know, they would have been immensely popular. But it's not popularity that determines what, you know, it's not people supporting, you know, ordinary people, voters supporting these things that is ultimately what's determining, you know, what gets passed. And, you know, the same is true of anything to do with climate, I think. In order to pass significant climate legislation, you have to confront these big industries. And right now, I just don't see the political forces, the balance of forces being marshaled in order to do that. I agree with you that it would be probably very popular if the White House decided to take that up, if the administration decided to take that up. But given the perverse incentives of a corporate captured Congress, I'm just not sure that that's going to happen, at least not in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think you're right. And others who have pointed out that the Biden plans could well even become something like the military-industrial complex, but for a different set of companies. Ultimately, they will show up in the corporate balance sheet as profits. Most of the money will go to the corporation. And in fact, even in climate change, the investor-owned utilities may in fact get lots of money for building out their humongously big, expensive, unnecessary, big continent-spanning grid. But the left doesn't have to develop its entire program in the next 2 or 3 years. What it needs to do, it seems to me, is become a contending force with an alternative vision of what a future could be. We need to have our alternative in contention. So we don't have to, in fact, defeat the investor-owned utilities, but what we can do is expand the amount of municipal, public, democratically run utilities, somewhat like the current public utilities that really still have about 10% of the market in the United States. They're moving rapidly to develop a new model of electricity generation, all near the point of use, and help reconstruct their city's transit system, and also run crusades for energy conservation and use reduction. All of those things are fundamental to reduce climate change to manageable levels, which is about the best we can ever imagine right now. And those programs, we need to develop a workable vision and demonstrate that it works, like in many cities in the United States that are becoming carbon free. Anyway, my sense is that if we can win just a substantial amount of the funds for child and elder care and for the climate change mitigation, that really does advance the left prospects in a future. And the future is coming very soon because the climate is now threatening in 10, 20, 30 years. The changes will have to be made and we could get in contention. Anyway, that's my hypothesis. Why don't you take the last word and comment on that?
You're right. I think at a certain point, there's going to be a necessity to do something. I mean, this moment as every moment going forward now does, represents, you know, our last best hope to take drastic action on climate change. I mean, the kind of incrementalist route that you're suggesting, if that's possible, I'd certainly welcome it. But again, it strikes me that confronting these big industries, these industries that are primarily responsible for pollution, and also doing so in a way which is paired with a sweeping jobs program so that, you know, you aren't just putting millions of people out of work. Doing that would require a very ambitious and activist type of governance. And I'm particularly kind of watching the reactions to last week's election, particularly the one in Virginia. I just don't get the sense that there's a lot of appetite to do that kind of thing among the people who are currently leading and guiding the Democratic Party. There was a concerted attempt, you saw, after Virginia to blame the left, which, you know, is kind of always what Democrats do when they lose, and to kind of move precisely further away from these kinds of, you know, these kinds of more ambitious and sweeping ambitions. But perhaps you'll be proven right and I'll be proven wrong here. I certainly hope so.
Luke Savage, thanks a lot for talking to us today. I hope we can talk in the future. These issues are not going away. They're just, in fact, intensifying. So keep up the good work, and thank you.
Thanks very much. We'll talk again.